Blog Talk Radio.
All right, we're here with another episode of the Iran Brook Show, and today, like we did, I think, a couple of months ago, we've got one of ARI's interns who is going to interview me during the show, so this should be fun. Last time it was a great show, so we've got Robert from San Diego State University, and Robert is an econ major over there, although he hasn't taken any econ classes yet, so... this is great. First of all, it's great to have you at Dan Renitschuk.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for tuning. You're going to be here through the holidays?
Mid-December.
Okay, cool. Excellent. Good. Well, what do you have?
Well, I want to start with the most recent event. So about the vice presidential debate, I know you were tweeting about it.
I was.
I just want to know what your final conclusions are about Pence and Kane.
Well, I mean... I would rather have them running than Hillary and Trump. I think they're both, although, you know, they're both mainstream, they're both conventional, they're both standard. Pence is a standard kind of conservative, not that strong. But I remember him as a congressman. He was not bad on economic policy. He was one of the better, more pro-free market guys on there. He panders to the religious right. I think he's part of the religious right, which I'm not happy about. So I wouldn't be happy about. Kane, I don't know what Kane stands for, so I don't really have a sense for Kane. I always thought he was more of the middle-of-the-road, moderate part of the Democratic Party, certainly not a Bernie Sanders radical or Elizabeth Warren radical lefty. So, I think an election between the two of them would be a lot less damaging, or any one of them becoming president would be a lot less damaging than Trump and Clinton. I thought Kane was obnoxious in the sense that he kept interrupting and he came across, but people seem to like that, so I don't know, maybe it was a good strategy. Pence was clearly embarrassed by the need to defend Donald Trump. I would be too if I was in his shoes and had to defend some of Donald Trump's statement, but I think he did a good job. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. What matters is, I guess there's another debate. There are two more debates coming up, although this show might be airing after those debates had already screened. But at the end of the day, it's the presidential debates that matter. The vice presidential debates never matter. I still remember watching the vice presidential debate where Lloyd Benson said to Dan Quayle, you know, I knew JFK, I was friends with John F. Kennedy, and Senator, you are no John F. Kennedy, and he crushed him, right, with that one statement. He had won the debate, no question, and yet Dukakis and he got crushed in the general election, so it didn't make any difference, and I think that's generally true of vice presidential debates.
So you think they're just safer and more predictable conservatives and Democrats to, I guess, make Trump and Hillary more appealable to their bases, or?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. So I think what happens is that both they were chosen, both Kane and Pence were chosen in order to appeal to the more conventional base. So Kane was certainly chosen with the idea that look, Hillary's not really this radical lefty. Don't pay too much attention to those Bernie Sanders stuff. We're really more like Bill Clinton was, kind of middle-of-the-road Democrats, which is still bad, but on most issues. But we are not we're not going to be crazy lefty. And even though she is clearly tempted to gravitate towards her left, towards Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. He is there to appeal to the more middle-of-the-road Democrats. I think in Pence's case, yeah, Trump is a completely unconventional candidate. He's completely out there. His base of support is not a typically Republican base of support. It's all over the map. And Pence was there to show up kind of the conservative, religious right, conventional Republican base, very much establishment. He was in the House of Representatives for years and years and years. You know, he would also be, if Trump got elected, he would also be a good VP in the sense that he knows how Washington works. So he, and Trump was looking for somebody who knew how Washington worked. So Trump is not used to, for example, negotiating with anybody about how to run his business, but he's going to have to negotiate with the House and the Senate about laws and about legislation. We hope, right? We hope he doesn't declare martial law and take over, but so, which I don't think he will. But so, you know, to the extent that he is going to govern as a president of the United States, he needs somebody who knows how to deal with Congress, and Mike Pence is that kind of person. He's respected by the establishment, but also by the kind of religious right, by the Ted Cruz, you know, supporters probably kind of support Pence. So he was there to bring people together, and I think that's his job. And I think he did for that purpose, that political purpose, he did his job during the vice presidential debate.
Okay. So one of the main themes of this election has been this rebellion against globalism. And for example, we have this protectionism, which is economic absurdity. But there's, like, for example, in the case of Brexit, they called a rebellion against bureaucratic and cultural negatives. Is there any substance to that, or is it a masquerade?
So, you know, there are two things going on here. One is, and I think they're all playing out as a, in a sense, as a mixture, as a package deal, if you will. So in the United States, clearly there's, I see this all the time, people talking about globalism and the evils of globalism and the problems of globalism. But it's a package deal because they package into it both legitimate issues with globalism. For example, this idea that the UN is going to now control the internet or that the UN should have control over the internet, or the United States ceding its sovereignty to international bodies like the United Nations. And there's certainly an element on the left who would like us to abide by the International Court in The Hague, to go by the UN, and to cede as much sovereignty as possible. And that's definitely a negative trend and something that should be fought. But they lump into that issues of free trade. So it's a package deal. In objectivism, a package deal is where you take a concept and you put stuff into it that are contradictions, that don't really belong together. So the opposition to the UN has nothing to do with free trade. But when you package it in, what you're trying to gain for the issue of trade, you're trying to get the credibility of being anti-UN. And that's what I think Donald Trump has done. That's what the so-called alt-right has done. That's what generally many people on the right have done. They've taken the issue, which we should all be legitimately concerned about, U.S. giving up sovereignty to the UN, to the international courts, to things like that, and lumping it with free trade. Look, free trade is unequivocally a good thing. Now, a lot of people say, but wait a minute, NAFTA is not free trade. That's true. But it's a move towards free trade. It's certainly better to have NAFTA than not to have NAFTA. NAFTA reduced tariffs on both the Mexican side and the U.S. side. NAFTA has made the United States more competitive. For example, our auto industry is more competitive because we can build parts in Mexico, ship them to Detroit, and build cars cheaper than we could otherwise. Now, whether the U.S. car industry should exist at all is a question, right, given that it had to be bailed out by the government. It's not clear that we're good at making cars, that we have any competitive advantage in the world making cars, and maybe that capital should be moved out of Detroit and given to Silicon Valley, in a sense, and maybe we should be investing in the things we're actually good at rather than things that we're bad at. But the fact is that NAFTA qua NAFTA has increased jobs, increased standard of living, lowered the cost of goods for the United States. So it's a mythology that now Clinton and Trump seem to be advocating for. It's a mythology that this is a bad thing. The trade is somehow bad. So these trade deals were not optimal. Optimal for me is lowering tariffs to zero, right? That's true free trade. Because they lower trade generally, because they open up markets more than they would otherwise be, without NAFTA, we would have high tariffs. Mexico would have high tariffs. There would be very little flow of goods between the two countries. The fact that we've lowered that we have that is a good thing. So globalism as it's used today is an anti-concept. There's no such thing as globalism because it's mixed up these things that are actually contradictions and they're actually are not right. Free trade or any movement towards free trade or any deal that moves us somewhat towards more free trade is a good thing. And some of these things are difficult to assess. Is TPP, this Trans-Pacific deal, does it actually move us towards free trade or doesn't it? I suspect it probably does, but it probably doesn't do it in any kind of significant way. The real answer is to be advocates of real free trade, which means lower trade barriers, even if that means unilaterally, and try to put as much pressure as possible in countries around the world to lower free trade as much as they can, to lower barriers to entry as much as they can, and use whatever means we have in terms of foreign policy to put that pressure on them. That would be the best type of trade deal possible. It's not what Trump is advocating. It's not what Clinton is advocating. It's not what, unfortunately, anybody on the campaign trail is advocating. There is no market candidate out there. So, again, globalism, I would never use that term. It's a bad term to use given the way people understand it today.
So then globalism is just an emotional scare tactic, and they're using the vehicle of emotion to push this agenda. Would an objectivist need to use emotion to push back on that, or if it would elicit value in the world at large, even though emotion goes against objectivist values?
Well, emotion doesn't go against objectivist values, right? Emotion is part of life, and emotion is an important part of life. We experience life through our emotions. We need to be very attuned to our emotions. Emotions are important. Emotions are signals about how we are reacting to the world. We experience joy and happiness and the good stuff, but we also fear and the bad emotions are important too because the signals about what's going on and if only about our own psychological state. The point is that emotions are not tools of cognition. You don't know about the world through your emotions. You know about your own psychological state and you know about your response to the world through your emotions, but you don't learn about external reality through your emotions. And other people shouldn't either. So you shouldn't make emotional arguments because you don't want to encourage people to be guided by their emotions. So emotions shouldn't guide you in your decision making. So we should be making reasoned arguments because reason is our means of cognition. Reason is our tool for arguing. Reason is our tool for understanding. And we should respect that in other people. Other people's tool for cognition should also be reason. If we sink to the level of being emotional, we've given up on the human race. We've given up on argument. We've given up on human beings. And you know what? Given the moral code that is prevalent in the world out there, given the ignorance of economics that's prevalent out there, given just the general ignorance that's given out there and the bad philosophical premises that people hold, the other side is always going to beat us when it comes to emotion. So we need to win on reason. That's how you find out the truth. That's how you find out facts. Now, that doesn't mean you have to be boring. It doesn't mean you can't be passionate. It doesn't mean you don't bring emotion to it. But at the end of the day, your argument needs to be an argument, and the only argument is a reasoned argument, and that's what the other side doesn't have, and therefore they rely purely on emotion, and that's why I think we can win, given enough time and given enough education, we can win because we have fact, reality, and reason on our side.
Okay. So it'd be better to not compromise than to maybe allow the state to grow for a little bit longer, or?
No, I mean, we should certainly not compromise in our positions. Now, you know, granted, people in politics are going to compromise, and certainly there's no reason for the state to grow at all. I mean, the state, you know, if you had a decent politician, the state should be shrinking from day one. There's absolutely no, the state is way too big, but it's not just big, it's unlimited in its scope. It deals with things, it's involved in things, it uses coercion in so many of our activities as human beings that it just doesn't belong there. So from day one, you should be able to shrink the involvement in government, in business, in business regulations, in business subsidies, in business controls, in running our lives through, whether it's licensing laws and a whole multitude of regulations that control our behavior, but also on a bunch of social issues where the government has no role in intervening in how we live and what we do and when we do it. And then get them out. I mean, from day one, we should start unwinding the state involvement in our health care, for example, in education, in trade. I mean, the state just has no role in trade. The way to think about trade is countries don't trade. Countries don't trade. Individuals trade. So we might trade, and you might happen to live in China, and you're making shoes, and I went in the market for shoes. And, yeah, there's some middlemen in between us, like the wholesaler in China and Walmart or Nordstrom in America. And those guys trade, and then I trade with them. But ultimately, I'm trading with you. You're making the shoe, and I'm buying the shoe. And the government has no role in placing barriers or taxes between me and the manufacturer of the shoes. I don't care if they're local in the United States or in China. That's who cares, right? The question is only, what is the quality of the shoe and what is the price? And if you in China can make a better shoe at a lower price, the American thing to do is to buy the best product possible at the lowest price, because the American thing to do is to pursue your own happiness, not to benefit so-called America, this abstraction that is America, the state that is America. Your goal is to benefit yourself. America is there only to protect your ability to pursue your happiness. So it's there to protect your ability to buy the cheapest product at the best price, not to interfere in your ability to buy the cheapest product at the best price. Buy American, as Harry Benswang, a board member and a philosopher of the Ayn Rand Institute, a board member of the Ayn Rand Institute, a philosopher who knew Ayn Rand, says, buy American is un-American. It's un-American to look at the label. You know, given that you know, you're not opposed to a regime, like I'm not going to buy anything from Cuba because anything from Cuba goes to government, right? But given that you're not opposed to that, looking at the label is un-American. You're supposed to look at the quality and at the price. That's it. That's what being an American means. So shrinking government, you could do tomorrow. You could lower tariffs. You could lower taxes. You could lower subsidies. You could lower controls. You can eliminate massive quantities of regulation from day one. And the net effect of all that would be, from day one, growth in the economy. I would fire, you know, on day one, I would fire 10% of government employees and then do 10% like every few months, right? So you could shrink government dramatically, quickly, and the economy would take off.
So could a proper objectivist, would a proper objectivist of their own, would it be in their interest to go into government if that's what they wanted to do for less than $50 million?
So you're referring to my challenge to bring me a check of $50 million so I'd go into politics. You know, I know objectivists that have gone into politics, and I think as long as they are objective about what can be achieved, as long as they're realistic about what can be achieved, I think at this point in human history, the most that can be achieved is education. We can go out and educate people about the ideas, use the political platform to gain an audience that maybe is not listening to the show, maybe is not coming to my talks, maybe is not reading Ayn Rand. But so if you view it from an educational perspective, you're not going to get elected. And if you got elected, right, let's say to the House or to the Senate or to the City Council, or what are you going to do, right? The laws are the laws. You have to follow the laws, right? So, yeah, you could fight against them, but more as an educational campaign than as really changing government, as really shrinking government. And as long as you view it in that perspective, then I think it's fine for an objectivist to go into politics. And I think it's good, actually. I think more objectivists getting involved in the educational campaign. It's just the question one has to ask, is it worth one's time? Is this the most effective way to use one's time? And some people would enjoy it. Like, as I said, for $50 million, I think I would have fun doing it. And they, given that the money wouldn't be coming out of the educational programs of the Ayn Rand Institute, it would be money that would typically not go to the Ayn Rand Institute. This would be new money. I think it would a campaign I did would resonate, would get a lot of viewers. The listenership to the radio show would go up. We would have basically a $50 million marketing budget for the idea, so that's a good thing. But you have to think about, is it worth your time and is it worth the money? Are there better uses for the money? Are there ways in which we can help shape the world, change the world, bring these ideas to a broader audience that are better than the political than politics? I don't know what the answer to that is, and to some extent everybody's going to have to make up their own mind. And do you have a personality for politics, right? Could you be up there on stage? Like Gary Johnson, as I've said on some shows, I don't think he has a personality for this stuff because he's too meek. He's too spaced out. I mean, I think he smokes too much weed to actually be a politician because I think it dulls the brain. I'm going to get in trouble now. But, you know, it is what it is, right? If you go up on stage in a presidential debate and say, yeah, I just smoked a joint, so I'm a little fuzzy right now, you're not a good candidate. You shouldn't be running for president. It's stupid. So anyway, I think I'd be great in the debates. I think I would crush them. I think I would intrigue the American public. I still think I would lose in a landslide, but I think at the very least people would be interested in going out and reading some books and listening to more.
What are your thoughts on Paul Ryan and Ron Paul, who say they're objectivists or they like Ayn Rand, but they may not necessarily abide by objectivist principles all the time?
Yeah, no, let's be clear. Neither one of them have ever said they're objectivists. They're not. They never claimed that, so they've not lied. Both have said, well, let's say this. Paul Ryan has said he was influenced by Ayn Rand, that reading Atlas Shrugged is what convinced him to go into politics, that he was sympathetic to a lot of the ideas. He never claimed to be an objectivist. Rand Paul has said he enjoys Ayn Rand's books, but clearly, you know, he's not an objectivist. He's very, both of them claim to be very religious. Paul Ryan is Catholic and is claimed to be a Thomist. I don't know if he knows what that is, but he claims to be a Catholic, and Rand Paul is definitely a Christian as well. And they're also just philosophically, I don't think they're that familiar with Ayn Rand. That is, they've read the books, but I don't think they've really studied her philosophy. And to really be an objectivist, one has to really study the ideas and know what they imply, because politics is the least important thing to come out of Ayn Rand's philosophy. It's really a philosophy. Ayn Rand's ideas, objectivism, is what she said was, it's a philosophy for living on Earth. It's a philosophy for living. It's how you live your life as an individual. And I don't think either one of them takes it that way. They've taken some political ideas and they sympathize with them. They've taken some images and they sympathize with them. I think Paul Ryan was more sympathetic to Ayn Rand, you know, 10 years ago than he is today. I think it became clear to him that saying nice things about Ayn Rand was a political liability. I think the Romney campaign clearly told him he had to throw Ayn Rand under the bus in order to be a vice presidential candidate. I mean, in spite of all that, I have to admit, and again, I think people will hate me for this, I kind of like Paul Ryan. I think he's smart. I think he's interesting. He never stands by his principle. He has no backbone. I know that. But he's smart, and I like smart people. That is, he comes up with new ideas. Every budget he's proposed when he was chairman of the committee in the House that develops budgets was interesting. He came up with the idea for vouchers for Medicare, which I think is the step in the right direction for doing away. Now, he stepped back from that because he came under a lot of pressure. He was throwing grandmothers off cliffs and stuff like that. But he has good ideas. He's a politician at the end of the day. And in the world we live in today, politicians cannot be objectivists in the sense that they can't say, we want to eliminate all government. I mean, because they can't win, and then they can't do anything when they're there. That's why if you got elected as an objectivist to the House of Representatives tomorrow, your moral obligation would be to vote no on everything. There's not a single bill, I suspect, that deserves a yes vote that comes there. So what are you doing? So as a politician, you know, you're not really adding value. Again, it's more educational, right? You can go out there and say, I voted no, this is why, and that's good that it's educational. Paul Ryan is non-objectivist, but he comes up with good ideas to move us from where we are today to a little bit less statism, and I support that. Rand Paul does the same thing. He presented probably the best budget I've ever seen presented by a politician. He did that, I don't know, when he was first voted into the Senate a few years ago. And the budget basically cut $500 billion from the following year's spending. That's amazing. And I think there were three senators that signed on to that. It was him, Mike Lee, and Ted Cruz. I think those are the three senators that signed on to this budget. Now, that's a budget I can get excited about. That's something that should be promoted, should be advocated for. But again, I think over time, he's become more moderate and again, he's not a very good politician in the sense that he's too soft-spoken and he's not radical enough. So instead of running on that budget when he ran for president this last campaign, he ran away from that budget. He didn't really push it. That budget should be in front and center of his campaign. Here's how you cut $500 billion from government spending. This is how you change America. What's he got to lose? He's going to lose anyway. Educate. This is my whole point. If you're going to run, and you're going to lose anyway, and this is the attitude I would take, no way would I ever get elected. So I'm going to use this to educate. I'm going to be radical. I'm going to be in your face. I'm going to talk about what really matters. I'm going to be non-PC, but smart non-PC as compared to stupid non-PC, which is Donald Trump. And we're going to talk about real issues that are controversial. So I'm going to go after, I'm going to be advocate for the separation of state and church, even though I'll lose the religious right, because I'm not going to get the religious right anyway. I'm not going to win anyway. I'm going to go out there and really say what I think, and that would be refreshing. And that's what Rand Paul should have done, and he should have run with that budget, and that's what Paul Ryan, if he ever runs for president, should do. But, so they do what they can, but they are the tiniest minority to the extent that they have good views. They're the tiniest minority. And to the extent that they have conventional views, they're just conventional politicians. But neither of them, let's be very, very clear, neither of them are objectivists. Neither of them are true advocates of free market economics. Neither of them are true Austrians, although Rand Paul probably knows Austrian economics quite a bit because he comes from a certain tradition. And at least Rand Paul has, in my view, a terrible foreign policy. Paul Ryan, I don't know what his foreign policy is. So, yeah.
So if an objectivist politician, if the best they can hope for is to be a Ross Perot to influence the ideas in the political sphere, for the most part, are objectivists just waiting till the political climate gets so painful that people have no choice but to back away from it?
Yeah, I think the point that's important about objectivism is that it's not a political movement. It's not about politics. Politics, is we believe, is the end result. Politics flows from culture. Culture is determined by ideas. Culture is determined by philosophical ideas. Politics is dictated at the end of the day by the voters, by the ideas that the voters have. And the ideas the voters have are determined by the ideas the intellectual elites have. And as long as the intellectual elites are liberal, a leftist, are progressives, or whatever you want to call them, but leftist, I like to call them leftist. Liberal is too nice of a term for them. So as long as they're leftist, then the ideas dominating our culture will be leftist, whether they're coming from Republicans or from Democrats. So you'll get a candidate like Donald Trump, who's a leftist on almost every issue, including trade and including immigration. Those are leftist, anti-trade and anti-immigration is a leftist agenda item. It's never been an agenda item for a free market right, although I'm not sure there is such a thing as a free market right. And objectivism, I don't think, is left or right. I think we're third dimension. We're separate from both of them. So my view is objectivism's goal short-term or midterm has to be to focus on ideas, to focus on intellectuals, to focus on changing the intellectual debate in the culture, to change the ideas that are being discussed, to appeal to the American people with new philosophies, new ideas, and to change the culture ultimately, to change what's going on in the world. And politics will flow from that. So politics will be a consequence. Politics is never the cause. Politics is always the consequence. So in the big picture, getting involved in politics right now is a waste of time. Again, unless it's an educational mission. Down the road, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, 100 years, I don't know how long. These things take a long time. We got to, I mean, it's an important point to make. Objectivism is really, 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 really radical. It's radical philosophically. So it goes against the prevailing ideas in the culture. It believes, Ayn Rand takes seriously the idea that reason is the only means of knowledge. Only means of knowledge. No mystical revelation. No finding knowledge in the Old and New Testament. No finding knowledge in your preacher on a Sunday afternoon. Reason, your sense data, your thinking, your mind is the only way to know the world. And you have to rely on your own mind because other people can't do your thinking for you. So you have to be independent. You have to stand on your own 2 feet. You have to think for yourself. How many people do that? Almost nobody. I mean, really, at the end of the day, consistently throughout their lives. So convincing people to use their mind, to think for themselves, I mean, that's like, you know, a 50-year project. And then in morality, objectivism says the purpose of your life is to live for you, for your own happiness, for your own values, for living the best life you can live for yourself. Objectivism is not, you know, it rejects the idea, rejects it as evil, that you should live for other people, that you should sacrifice. Sacrifice, qua sacrifice, is a bad word, right, in objectivism. It's you don't give up your life, your values, for something of lesser value, less important to you. You strive to better yourself and rise up in terms of your value hierarchy, not go downwards. So it rejects altruism. So it rejects religious morality. It rejects socialist morality. It rejects secular morality. It's got a whole new moral code of rational self-interest, rational egoism, which says think for yourself, live for yourself. Be honest, not because primarily because you care about your own mind, because you want to be faithful to the facts and to reality and to the truth. You know, have pride in your own achievement. Don't be humble in a sense of humility being degrading yourself. Be proud of your true achievement, not false pride, a real pride of what you've achieved. So because we value the human mind and because we value individual human happiness, and only because of that, do we believe individuals have a right to live their life as they see fit? Because they're the only people who can make decisions for themselves. So we're against central planning, not because you can't have a smart enough central planner, which is Hayek's view. We reject Hayek's view about reason. We don't have a central planner because a central planner can be inside my head and decide my values. Only I can decide what's good for me. Nobody else can decide what's good for me. It's not a matter of him not being smart enough. It's a matter of only me being smart enough to decide what's good for me. Nobody else can decide what's good for me. So because we believe in that, we don't believe in central planning. And, of course, from a pure economic science perspective, central planning is a failure exactly because of this reason. Only individuals can decide what's good for them. So it works economically, and it works morally, and it works philosophically. So and only then do you get a politics. What is the role of government? The role of government is to ban force. Is to extract force from human interaction. So it needs a police and a military and a judicial system. That's it. Nothing else. Not because other stuff doesn't work, but because that's not the role, the philosophical, moral role of government. The role of government is to protect me. As George Washington understood, government is force. Government is a gun. The only job of a gun is protection. It's never offensive. It's never coercive. So, you know, there's a whole stream of philosophy here until you get to a free society, until you get to the economics. So the battle is in epistemology. It's about the efficacy of reason, and it's in morality. It's about the validity of the morality of self-interest and a rejection of altruism. And if we win those two battles, then we'll win the political battle easily. But you can't start with politics. You can talk about politics as a way of educating people about morality and about epistemology, but not as an end in itself.
So you mentioned Washington, I guess, just as regarding the Constitution and protection from force. One of the more radical ideas proposed by Milton Friedman was a economic Bill of Rights. I don't know if that'd be viable, but is that what people need to prevent a continuation of these force? Because clearly the Constitution hasn't been upheld.
Well, no, the Constitution is misunderstood. Nobody understands the Constitution. Nobody today, including all the justices of the Supreme Court, have no concept of what individual rights mean and how to apply the idea in the Declaration of Independence to the Constitution and therefore to rulemaking. And this is true of Scalia when he was alive. This is certainly true of all the justices today. None of them get the Constitution. None of them get the context in which America was founded. And therefore, most of their rulings, even when they get the ruling right, their reasoning is often, or almost always, wrong. It's not an issue of an economic bill of rights. So that would help. I mean, the whole point that Madison's is that we view some list of rights as definitive, as it. No, I mean, the whole point of our Constitution is you as an individual are free to do whatever the hell you want. Now, the goal of this freedom is to pursue the rational values necessary for your own life. But you are free to pursue your life as you see fit. Period. Like, as long as you're not violating somebody else's rights, there is no role for government. Now, the Constitution is there to protect the good guys to achieve happiness, to pursue their happiness, to pursue their life, liberty, and happiness. But everybody gets to be free, even the irrational, even the people who are going to screw up their lives. They all get to be free, and they all get to suffer the consequences of their actions or to benefit from the consequences of their actions. And the government has no role in that. And Madison worried that if they listed rights, this is why he was initially against the Bill of Rights, if they listed the rights, then they would say, okay, these 10, that's it, that's all. And this is why, it even says there, these enumerated rights are not all the rights, but nobody gets that. Nobody understands that. You have a right to your life, which includes everything about your life. So you have a right, I mean, just to be controversial, you have a right to sell your organs. You have a right to prostitute your body. You have a right to commit suicide, right? Not because any of those things are good things, right? But because in order to protect good people's rights to pursue their reason in pursuit of their own happiness, one has, because the government is should never be involved in deciding what are proper values to pursue and what are improper values, we have to allow people to act in sometimes in stupid ways and irrational ways because we, the government, don't decide what's rational, what's irrational. That means you cannot have bans on drugs. You cannot have bans on what people do with their own body. It's not the job of government to decide what are irrational values and what are rational values. So what we really need, from an economics perspective, is a constitution, and I would revise the constitution. I know people are horrified by this idea because I think the constitution is not clear enough. Because I think the founders didn't have a good understanding of capitalism because they lived in a pre-capitalist world. They lived in it before, so it needs to be revised and it can be improved. I think what needs to be explicit in the Constitution is a separation between state and economics. So just like we have a separation of state and religion, there should be a separation of state and economics. There should be some amendment to the Bill of Rights that said the government should pass no laws that affect trade, that affect people's employment, that affect the goods and services being produced and being committed. It's only responsibilities to protect us from fraud. That's it, right? And theft of property. So that's it. So other than that, should leave us alone. And so you need to have a clear articulation of a separation of state from economics. In a free society, government is not pro-capitalism or pro-socialism or pro-anything. Government is there to protect your rights. That's it, to protect you from crooks and fraud. You want to be a communist in a capitalist, government, in a free, that's fine. Get a bunch of your friends, go start a commune, give to each according to their needs, from each according to their ability, as long as you don't use force, as long as you don't, coerce one another, go at it. You'll suffer, you'll be miserable, it's a pathetic existence, and it's psychologically devastating, but that's your problem, it's not my problem, and it's certainly not the government's problem. So under freedom, people can experiment in different ways in living, and it's their responsibility as long as they get to suffer the consequences, and the consequences are not bloated on somebody else.
I think there's definitely been a perversion of the idea of rights. I mean, especially if you look at Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, and I mean, if you look at Bernie Sanders, he didn't go to medical school, but he has the gall to tell other people how to use their skills.
Yeah, but you see, there's been a perversion of rights across the entire spectrum, political spectrum, an entire philosophical, ideological spectrum. There is literally nobody in America today, I'm exaggerating, but there's literally nobody on the Supreme Court today who understands where rights come from and what rights are. And this is true of the right as well. And this is why they can be anti-abortion. This is why they can be anti-gay marriage. You know, if you understand rights as protecting the ability of an individual to live his life free of coercion, then how can you reject the idea of marriage between two consenting adults? It's none of your business, right? They want a contract. Who are you to intervene? Or a mother's right to decide what she does with her body. So there's nobody out there. So yeah, Bernie Sanders clearly invents new rights, but so does the right. Or the right rejects rights or interprets it as if in some, you know, textualist way, as Scalia would do, where he reads the words and the words have meaning above and beyond the context in which they were created, which is bizarre. I mean, it's a religious mentality. It's the meaning of the words is in the word. No, the meaning of the words in the context and in the definition and you know what the concept actually contains. It's not some intrinsicist rigid thing that you it was revealed to you through some kind of mystical revelation. So the whole idea of rights has been perverted to the point where the left says we have a right to health care, we have a right to education, we have a right to food, we have a right to a job, you have a right to feel secure, you have a right now not to be offended on some university campuses. None of those could be true. So, and of course, the right has no answer to that. Oh, they go, oh, they're only negative rights. No, I mean, it's not negative or positive. Rights are there to do a positive thing, to protect rational people's ability to pursue their happiness. That's what rights are there to do, to protect. So it's a positive. So the whole idea of positive rights and negative rights, this is one principle. You cannot have a right to other people's stuff. You cannot have a right to other people's lives, to other people's time, to other people's things, right? And the role of government, and this is why you do have a right to be protected, and this is why it's okay to pay policemen to protect you. You can only have a right to live free. And it's the job of government to secure that right, to secure it, to protect you from terrorists and criminals and fraudsters. But, everything else, you have a right to. I have a right to health care in the sense that I have a right to choose whatever doctor will accept me, to pay him as much as me and the doctor can negotiate, to have whatever medical procedure I think is appropriate and that I find a doctor who's willing to do at the price that we agree on, no matter what the Department of Health and Human Services or the FDA or Bernie Sanders or, for that matter, my insurance company thinks if I am willing to pay the bill. That is, as long as I negotiate the procedure and I find a doctor who's willing to do it and we come up to a degree, that's what a right to health care means. I have a right to an education. I have a right to go out there and find the best teacher in the world who can educate my kids, to negotiate with them whatever price is appropriate, to teach my kids whatever I want and she or he is willing to teach them, irrespective of what the Department of Education, at the state, local, federal, this is the thing I hate about Republicans, oh, local. I don't care if the dictator is local or if he's federal. If he's a dictator, he's a dictator, right? I just want to be free to go out there and pursue my life, and that means negotiate the best deals that I can with. And I don't care if I have to import a teacher from China because I want my because the best teacher in the world lives in China. It's none of the government's business that I employ somebody from China and bring them in. How can it be the government's business if I find a great teacher in China and I invite her to come to the United States to teach my kids that I now need to get permission from the state in order to do that. That's the whole anti-immigration thing. That's absurd in a free society. So, again, we have to understand what freedom is, what rights are. I have a right to pursue my happiness. I have a right to live with everything that that implies. And the left and right don't get it. They have no clue about it. And this is why I also, you know, people say, this election's all about the Supreme Court. So, you know, is Trump going to elect better Supreme Court justices than, well, it depends. If you're gay and you're worried about your life as a gay person, Hillary's probably going to elect better Supreme Court justices than Trump on social issues. Trump is going to elect really bad Supreme Court justices. And even on economic issues, look at what Roberts did to Obamacare. He voted for Obamacare. So, and he's like a real conservative. He's, you know, so even on economic issues, we can't trust the right. And on social issues, we certainly can't trust the right. And even when they rule on better things from the economic issues, they often do it from wrong reasons, which will later come back to bite us because the whole reasoning of the court is bad. So it's not clear to me that there are clear-cut better Supreme Court justices out there that one side will vote for, and you know that Trump is much better on the Supreme Court than Hillary. I'm not convinced of that. Now that'll really get me in trouble.
So, are our rights purely a metaphysical or epistemological thing, and it's just the government's duty to protect them? I mean, if we don't have a police force or an army and someone violates the non-aggression principle, then
there is no such thing as a non-aggression principle, right? There's a non-aggression. I mean, many libertarians want to pretend that there's some kind of non-aggression axiom that we start with non-aggression is not self-evident. If I can force you to do something that's good for you, like force you not to take heroin, clearly that's good for you. Why shouldn't I be able to force you not to take heroin? Most people would say, well, of course you can force somebody not to take heroin. Of course you can force somebody not to jump off the bridge. Of course you can force people. So force throughout all of human history has been a quite acceptable means by which to manipulate people to do what society or what the philosopher king or what the dictator thinks is good for them. So libertarians miss the whole point. Morality is, it certainly has epistemological roots, but what rights are, rights have epistemological roots, but what rights are moral concepts. They are ethical concepts. They are derived from the idea that you are responsible for your own life. You're responsible for your own happiness, for your own success. And your moral obligation is to pursue your own life. And then the question becomes, okay, once I get into a human environment where there are other people, and we know from studying history and from looking around us that other people can interfere physically with my ability to pursue my own values, then we need to recognize that in this social context, in order for people to be moral, to pursue their moral obligation, which is towards their own happiness, they have to be protected from coercion. So we need a concept to capture that idea, to capture the idea that in a social context, we have to be protected in order to pursue our own lives, and we have to have a system that protects each one of us and also protects us from things that are accidental, recognizes that accidents can happen, which means we need a system of rights. We need the recognition, and this is what a right is, it's the recognition that each one of us, you know, is a moral agent in pursuit of their own happiness, in pursuit of their own rational values. And then in to do that, because reason is at the core of the pursuit of your happiness, the enemy of reason is coercion. Therefore, we have to extract coercion from society. Rights is the concept that recognizes that. But it's not given to us by God. It's not intrinsic in us. It comes out of a conceptual, epistemological, conceptual recognition of what is necessary for human beings to thrive and be successful. The goal, individual to thrive and successful. The means, no coercion. Rights are, in a sense, rights are the non-aggression principle. individual rights say, I have, I am free to act in pursuit of my rational values for the purpose of the of happiness. It's the recognition of my right, of my freedom of action. It's a freedom of action, right? It's a recognition. So it's not metaphysical in the sense that God gave it to us and somehow imprinted into our DNA. It's a consequence of our nature and our need to pursue reason in order to flourish, and therefore we need to extract force, and therefore we need to be left alone, left free. And that's what rights recognize. I need our metaphysical need, if you want, a moral need to be left free to pursue our own values.
Well, would taking heroin be a rational value?
No, it wouldn't be. And government is not instituted to protect your ability to take heroin. But because government is instituted in order to protect rational people's ability to pursue their rational values, it by default protects your ability to take heroin. Because it's not the job of government to decide what rational values are and what irrational values are, even when the evidence is clear-cut. I mean, and you think historically about this. You know, there was an era in which people thought that the sun went around the earth, and that was conventional wisdom, and 97% of all scientists believed that, right? And now, if government has no business in that, then there's a scientific debate, and ultimately Galileo would win that debate, and ultimately everything's fine. But the Catholic Church viewed itself as government that had a position here, and it said, no, we agree with the scientists who believe that the sun goes around the earth. And Galileo, you shut up, and we put you under house arrest. And he was lucky because people before him were burnt at the stake for believing these kind of things. And science would have started a lot earlier if the Catholic Church wouldn't have silenced many of the early scientists who were discovering new things that contradicted what the Catholic Church at that point in time believed that the Old or New Testament claimed. And the Old Testament clearly, it says that the sun goes around the earth. There's no question about that. That's what the Old Testament says. Nobody reads the Old Testament. It's very convenient if you're religious not to read the actual book that has all your beliefs in it, but because they're contradictory and they're full of contradictions. But So you don't want an authority. You don't want an authority with a gun, which the Catholic Church had in those days, telling you what is a rational value and what is irrational value. So I don't want to protect. So I'm for drug legalization, for example, but not because I care one iota about people who take heroin. It's their problem. Overdose. I mean, I really don't care. It's stupid. It's irrational. It's anti-life. I have no sympathy. Now, I have some sympathy for people who accidentally get hooked on painkillers and stuff like that, and so there's some sympathy for that. But I certainly don't have sympathy for people who just go and they're shooting up heroin because they get a high from it and they don't want to take responsibility for their own life. So it's not my love of drug addicts that causes me to believe in, or my belief that, oh, everybody should have a right to go and do stupid things. No. It's that I don't want government involved in deciding what is stupid and what is not. I also believe that the criminalization of drugs corrupts the police because now they have to enforce laws that are victimless crimes. There is no crime here, really, right? You're just inflicting damage on yourself, not on somebody else. It corrupts the police. It corrupts the judiciary system. We put huge numbers of people in jail. And then, of course, they're the shootings where innocent people are dying because there's a drug war out there. So it's the fact that there are people who are not drug users who suffer because we criminalize drugs that bothers me. Drug dealers and drug users, I couldn't care one iota about.
Well, the one thing I've found odd about the police thing, specifically on the left, is that the left consistently demonizes the police or say that well, they're tools of institutionalized racism, for example, might be true. But at the same time, then they ask for more power to go to the state, and it's just an odd irony. Yep. I don't.
Well, partially because the left tries to deny that the state is coercive and that the state is one big gun and one big police force, in a sense. They constantly try to deny that. I get in debates all the time, and I say, well, the government uses force here. Oh, that's not force because we voted on it. Somehow that's not force. But look, the left, the new left, the Black Lives Matter left, the Elizabeth Warren left, the Bernie Sanders left, they're nihilists. Their goal is nothing else but to smash civilization. They want to destroy. They want to knock people who are successful down. They are motivated by hatred, and therefore they're motivated by hatred of the police. Now, it's sad because they're taking what I think is a real issue. Some of these police shootings are really, really horrific. Some of these policemen are doing stupid things, and that's really bad. They're taking a real issue of some unjust police shooting, and they're making it into the police are bad, there's institutionalized racism, maybe let's smash it all, right? Because their goal is to smash. And, of course, if you look at the Black Lives Matter, if you look at what they're really advocating for, they're anti-capitalist, anti-freedom, they're anti-everything good. And they're really, really a Marxist, anti-human life organization. But so taking a real issue and perverting it for a really evil agenda. And you see this over and over again in the left. But you have to the key to understanding this is not to why aren't they consistent? Of course they're not consistent. You know, that's the very nature of being anti-life and anti-American and anti-progress is to be inconsistent. What they really want is just to knock stuff down. They're the kids who didn't like to build towers but like to go and knock other kids' towers down. They're just mean people. They're nasty people. They want power. They want to control other people. Now, it's not that they think of themselves in this way. Nobody who belongs think, oh, yeah, I just want to smash that. They feel that, but they don't want to think it because nobody can face that kind of evil. I'm a destroyer. Nobody thinks that way, right? So they rationalize it. Oh, I'm just fighting for my ethno, gender, whatever, centric, whatever BS they come up with. But that's all a rationalization. It's all made up. It's all made up in their own minds to convince themselves that they're not really the nasty monsters that they really are. And this is true of the Paul Krugmans of the world, who's a nasty monster but will never admit it to himself, can't. So he has to come up with economic rationalizations and pretenses to justify his power-lusting agenda. It's true of Obama. It's true of Hillary. It's certainly true of Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren might be more aware of her own evil than most others. But, you know, these people are really they're about pulling stuff down. So they don't have to be consistent. They want more state power because they want to control you. They don't like the police because the police are protecting. And they would get a kick. What really gets them going, like a sexual thrill, if you will, is to see stuff burn down. They want riots in the streets. They want to see blood being spilt. They want the zombie apocalypse tomorrow, right? And the police are in their way. So one of the means by which they do that is to knock down the police. Now, part of the consequence of the zombie apocalypse is what? Is dictators usually come up to rise up to solve all your problems. They want to be the dictators. They, at the end of the day, they want to see destruction. They want to see control. Their control.
I mean, I don't know if you've gotten this feeling, but at least for, I guess, these cultural Marxist issues, it always feels like it feeds into Hillary's campaign and tries to distract people from maybe her not-so-attractive areas like her foundation or...
See, but nobody cares. So all these politicians are corrupt. Everybody's corrupt in politics, it seems like. I mean, it's so easy to be cynical, but I can't think of a not corrupt in some way or another politician out there. And people just don't care about the corruption, and they don't care about incompetence. I mean, one of the things that disappointed me about the vice presidential debate, certainly disappointed me in the presidential debate, because unfortunately Trump, I don't think is smart enough to actually launch an attack like this. But Hillary Clinton's whole public service is a failure. I mean, her foreign policy was a disaster. Her whole approach, you know, everything she touched in foreign policy fell apart. She's clearly corrupt. The speeches in front of Wall Street where she gets $250,000. I mean, she's not that good of a speaker. It's obviously a pay-for-play in some, people are paying. in order to get access. And I don't blame the investment bankers, but I do blame Hillary Clinton and the foundation and everything else. People don't want to know. They don't care. They because everybody's like that. All the politicians are like that. Trump's appeal is he's willing to call the corruption. He can't call her on her incompetence because he can't identify it. He doesn't know that it's her policies. I mean, they say a little bit about her policies that led to ISIS, but that's absolutely true. But, of course, it was George Bush's policies that led to ISIS as well. So it's the whole establishment from George Bush to Hillary Clinton to Kerry right now that has led to the disaster that is the Middle East, that led to Russia invading Crimea and being as aggressive as it is, to what's happening in Aleppo and happening in Syria, to even I'd say what's happening in Venezuela, the inability of the United States even intellectually to stand up to Chavez and then to this idiot Murano or whatever his name is in Venezuela. It's just made things much, much worse over there. It's the lack of any kind of leadership in the United States for free markets, for capitalism. The fact that the American elites have not explained to the world what actually happened during the financial crisis and let it be blamed on capitalism, so that even China is moving away from capitalism, moving away from more freedom, because they think that the financial crisis was caused by it. They don't want to have anything to do with that. So it's the whole establishment that is to blame. And in that sense, Donald Trump's right. He is just not capable of actually articulating the opposite case and actually articulating a case for what the alternative should and could be.
I mean, it's people don't really want to realize that politicians aren't corrupt or government often doesn't work. I mean, look at Bernie Sanders, who had a primary rigged against him, and then Debbie Wasserman Schultz got promoted. And I understand that he's worried about Trump, but he's still advocating for this larger government that really worked against him.
Yeah, but he would do the same thing, right? I mean, if he had the machinery of the Democratic National Committee, he would work it against Hillary. They're all corrupt, so they can't fight corruption, right? And Bernie certainly is one of the most corrupt politicians ever. I mean, this is a guy who supported the Sandinistas. This is a guy who supports socialism. I mean, instead of giving us as an example Denmark and Sweden, which are relative capitalist havens as compared to the socialism he would like to inflict on us, he should be looking at Venezuela, and yet he continues that. He just bought his third home. He has no problem with his wife making a lot of money as long as he gets the benefit from it, at the same time slamming people who make a lot of money. He and his wife inherited some money. They probably don't pay an estate tax because the estate tax, they probably inherited less than $5 million. So when he says he's going to lower the estate tax, would he really, or would he do it after he got his? I don't believe any of these guys. I think they're all corrupt. They don't have an ideology. They don't believe in anything. This notion that Bernie Sanders was this clean guy, you know, the guy's been in politics forever. He's as despicable and disgusting as they come, and he's much worse than Hillary, because he has this capacity to stand up there and pretend that socialism, he's a social democrat, and social democracy is a good thing. When he ignores the facts of reality, you know, he's for single-payer socialized medicine, and he ignores, he doesn't want to tell you that people die all the time, standing in line for an MRI, standing in line for a procedure that we in America take for granted we could do in 3 hours. They wait for months for these things, where they truly are, in a sense, death panels that allocate who should live and who should die, because they have to ration care, because the only way to deal with an aging population under socialized medicine is to ration care. So it's, but he'll never talk about that. He's dishonest. He's despicable. He's a, you know, so surprise, surprise, he's going to back Hillary Clinton against Trump. I actually, you know, I actually think he's more like Trump in many respects than Hillary, because, you know, as a populist, he just riled up the audiences. It's, again, it's not like he wanted power. You could tell how much he enjoyed getting these young people all excited, and he would say anything to get them excited.
Well, one of my favorite things about Bernie Sanders was the college his wife worked at. I mean, she drove it into debt from all the spending. And
was this a community college or a private college?
I think it was a private college.
I think it was a private college. And this is the same time that the Obama administration has launched basically a campaign using guns against private colleges all over the country. They're shutting them down. ITT was shut down. Colleges that are doing a noble, important job using the profit motive to educate people, people who can't go to Harvard, can't go to the University of Missouri, any university, don't have the skills and the educational background to go to these universities, and the community colleges are pathetic. I mean, these private colleges far outperform community college, and yet there's a war against them. There's a campaign against them to destroy them, to crush them. But nobody mentioned that, you know, what she did at this college, how bad it was, the kind of compensation she got. That was off limits, right? They can go after ITT. They can go after Corinthian here in California, but you can't touch Bernie Sanders' college, you know, his wife's college. So, yeah, I mean, this is politics. This is how corrupt it gets. And, you know, I'll give you an example. So the Obama administration crushes these private colleges, just annihilates them and goes after them. And so their stock prices plummet, right? And the University of Phoenix, its stock price just takes a beating. I don't know, it drops 80-90%, whatever it is. So it's pennies for the dollar. So the guy who used to be number two at the education department leaves the education department, goes out and raises money with the private equity funds and buys Phoenix University, right? And nobody says a word. Here he is taking advantage of the fact that he, at the Department of Education, crushed them, got the stock really, really cheap to buy it up so that he can make a lot of money for himself. I mean, that's just so corrupt. That's what the oligarchs did in Russia in the 90s and what we blame them for doing, right? It is so, so explicitly corrupt, and yet not a peep from anybody. Nobody cares. I bet you the Obama administration won't touch Phoenix University. They'll leave it alone. And if Hillary gets elected, they won't touch Phoenix because now it's owned by one of their guys. And that's what happens when politics gets into the economy and it corrupts. It corrupts everything. Everything government touches in the capacity as a regulator, as a control of economic activity, it destroys.
I think in the face of all these controversies with college, one of the biggest has been this whole free college debate. And I mean, they talk about Denmark as being an ideal, but it actually takes kids longer to graduate there, and they take degrees that don't really matter later. They have an engineering shortage because people don't want to take more difficult jobs.
Well, there are a lot of interesting things about Denmark. For example, the fact that in spite of the fact that college is free and everybody goes to college, there's less social there's about as much mobility in Denmark as there is in the United States. That is, in Denmark, that education is not used by these kids to advance economically, which is fascinating. There was just an article on that, a study that came out on that. So there's less so-called educational inequality than in the United States, but that is not reflected in economic inequality. That is, poor people don't rise up much faster in Denmark than they do in the United States when we control for the fact that the gaps are different. The gap is much higher in the United States than it is in Denmark. But what is free education? I mean, as I think it was Bastiat who said, and Milton Friedman maybe popularized, there is no such thing as a free lunch. Somebody is paying for it. So what is a free education? A free education just means a subsidized education, an education that you're stealing money from some and you're giving it in the form of education to others. And you've got a middleman called the university that's raking in the money from the fact that you stole it from all these other people. And there's no mechanism to control costs at the universities because the universities are just getting money from the government. And why, morally, why should I fund somebody else's education? I've got my own kids' education to fund, and I've got my own values and my own life to pursue. It's none of my business whether you get an education or not. And if I want to make it my business, then it's my business. But I get to choose. You don't get to choose for me. You don't get to coerce me to subsidize everybody else's education. And then do I have any say in the quality of education? Well, no, because my tax money is just taken from me. And then the government has a say in the quality of education. Oh, my God. Look what they did to public schools. Look what's happened to public education in the pre-college. They've destroyed it. It's a disaster, particularly if you're poor. So The last thing you want is now basically to nationalize all the universities by making their education free. What you will do is completely destroy education in America. So free education, so-called free education, is immoral. It's economically stupid. It will destroy education. It will destroy the kids who get into education. They won't have paid for it. They won't value it. You know, today, look at how many people take stupid degrees like in feminism and feminist literature or whatever. Imagine how many people would be doing that if it was free. You know, and it's useless. It's useless for their life. It's useless for their knowledge. They learn nothing. And it's just going to become worse. Why would, you know, and the whole perception that other people owe me. I'm owed an education, not just through K through 12. Now I'm owed an education through, when does it stop? Lifelong education. I want to be educated. I want to stay in school for the rest of my life. I know in Europe, people like staying undergrad forever because there's no incentive to leave. Because once they leave, they actually have to get a job. And everything's subsidized in school. Today, kids are living with their parents. Imagine if you made education free, how long they would live with their parents after school. The whole point is to grow up and go get a job and live your own life and stand on your own 2 feet. And all of these programs are geared towards suppressing that ability.
I mean, if you look at like Elizabeth Warren, I mean, she got paid $400,000 a year for teaching one class, which isn't any of my business. Get what you can get for it. But then she turns around and says, well, the government should subsidize college, and it's just a free stream of fiat currency.
Yeah, no, Elizabeth Warren got paid, that's right, $400,000 by Harvard University to teach a class and to be a professor, so to really to publish. And what she publishes is garbage, and what she is a horrible, horrible human being and a horrible, horrible legal scholar. But she gets $400,000 a year. And the university can afford to pay her that because tuitions go up and up and up, and there's no stopping tuitions from going up because students can get as much money as they want from the government. The government has no standard by which to decide whether to give you a loan or not. Anybody who applies for a loan basically gets it. So if it was a bank doing it, they would say, what degree are you getting? How are you going to pay us back? If you're studying feminist studies, how are you going to get your money back? What kind of a job would you have? And if you're going to a two-bit university in the middle of nowhere that has no reputation for placing any of their students, how are you going to pay the money back? It's too big of a risk. I'm not going to give you a loan. The government doesn't think so. There's a risk return kind of trade-off, right? So it incentivizes people to work harder. It incentivizes people to go to better schools. It incentivizes people to look at engineering, to look at areas where you can actually pay back your debt, because you're not going to get a loan otherwise. You're just not going to go to school. Government just writes a check. So the universities know they can jack up tuition as much as they want. Government would. So where does the money go? Some towards professor salaries, but mostly towards two things. Administrators. There are five times more administrators today than there were 30 years ago. Now more students, now more professors, but five times more administrators, right? And buildings. Have you seen the dorms that these universities are building now for kids? I mean, it doesn't surprise me that they don't want to leave college because life is so sweet. And once they leave college, they'll actually have to pay rent for a dump as compared to the dorm that they got at the university. So swimming pools at schools that have no real swimming programs that are magnificent facilities, what for? Because they can't, because they're flush with money. So the whole system's corrupt, and it's corrupted by government. Government has no role in education. If people want loans, they should apply to a bank, just like apply to a bank for any other kind of loans, or to charity. Charities should fund scholarships, but people then be guided towards professions that can actually pay them, you know, where they can get a return on the investment, and they were guided to schools that are better performing schools where they can actually get a job afterwards, and we wouldn't be squandering hundreds of billions of dollars on useless education the kids are getting.
From personal experience, I mean, when I first went to SDSU, they have like electronic water fountains, and the architecture's really extravagant, and it's all just so unnecessary. Like I just need a shack and a teacher.
And it's a state school, mm-hmm. right? And they keep raising tuition, and students keep demonstrating about raised tuition, but at the end of the day, nobody really cares because the student just gets more debt, and you guys all believe that President Clinton is going to forgive all your student debt anyway. So rack it up, right? Rack it up. I, you know, if I knew somebody was handing out free money, I'd go collect some too. And that's what students are doing. But it's a scam. The whole educational system today is a scam.
Well, they've been pushing kids in for 50 years, and the demand has, increased by half? And they didn't expect prices to go up so that they could...
Well, prices have gone up, again, I think primarily because of the subsidy, because government gives out loans without consideration of risk. So, and they're relatively, even though the interest rate is, you know, the government's making good money on the interest rate because interest rates are so low, but it's not a market interest rate because it's not correlated to risk. So it's free money. So already, in some senses, people view education as free, and that's why they're willing to take up all this debt. So yeah, the whole system's corrupt, and then we encourage everybody to go get a college degree, when not everybody should get a college degree, and not everybody should get a college degree in the stupid subjects they get college degrees in. They're college degrees that are useless, and they're college classes that are not value added, that teach nothing, where you're not getting an education. Indeed, you'll probably get an anti-education. It's like an, you know, anti-force. It's destructive to go to college. And indeed, I think at most Ivy League schools, if you're in the humanities, it probably does damage to your brain. No, I'm serious. I think it does, because it does damage to your thinking.
Mainly just because it's controlled by the left and they're pushing that agenda.
Because the subjects, there's no subject called feminism. What are you studying? Feminist interpretations of literature. There's no such thing. There is no subject like that. There is no female approach to or gender whatever neutral. There is, you know, these things don't actually exist as topics to study. And the same with the opposite. It's not that there's, you know, it's there's no such thing as, I don't know, postmodern A, B, C, D, Z. I mean, it's BS. You can study postmodernism. You can take a distance and you can study postmodernism. But postmodernism is empty of content at the end of the day. There's no there. So to study postmodern literature and postmodern this and postmodern that, it's destructive for your brain, because you learn anti-thinking. You learn the opposite of what it means to think. It's dissolving reality. It's teaching that reality isn't reality. Truth is not truth. Facts are not facts. That's not teaching. That's destroying. So much of the humanities today is destructive. They're not teaching you truths. They're not teaching you facts. They're not teaching you. They're not using reason. They're not reasoning with you. So it's invalid. It's not education. Again, it's destruction.
It's subjectivism.
Yeah, it's emotionalism, subjectivism. It's completely, you know, in some sense random, but it is. It's a subjectivist approach, driven, and it's trying to get you to be a subjectivist. You're a man. You can only understand this novel in this particular way because this is the male perspective on this novel, and to the extent that you buy into that, that's destructive to your own ability to reason, because it's not an issue of male or female. It's an issue of fact or not fact. And yeah, each one of us brings different experiences to the experience of reading the novel, and that's interesting to share those experiences. But what you're striving towards is the objective truth, is what is really there, and what can we learn from each other through those experiences. But that's not the same as the kind of attitudes and subjective non-objective, just broadly, attitudes that most professors have today. To all the sciences, this includes, you know, in economics, they're not interested in the truth, they're interested in the equation. They're interested in, can they derive something new out of the differential equation? That's not economics, that's math. And it's not even useful math. So it's only, you know, deriving another differential equation is only useful it's useful as an exercise, but it's only useful if you're going to do something with it. It's not useful in economics when you're actually talking about human behavior and interaction in markets. They don't behave like equations.
I find that really common when I'm talking to people about some form of cultural Marxism, that they assume that I can't have the cognitive ability to understand what's going on because of who I am, which I just find that offensive, and it's.
Well, you should ask them. Should ask them how come Marx could understand the proletarian when he was a middle class Jewish guy who never worked a day in his life, sat around in a library and wrote books funded by a rich Jewish guy, who never really did any manual labor in his life. What's his name? Engels, right? And both of these guys were pseudo-intellectuals who sat around writing letters to each other and writing books, and yet they understood the plight of the proletarian. If that's the case, then Marx had no clue. If you have to experience anything in order to know it, then Marx and Engels knew nothing because they had no experience at any of these things. So the whole idea is an anti-reason idea. It's an anti-cognition idea. It's an idea that you can only learn through muscle. You can only learn through experience, that you can't think, that emotions are primary, and therefore you need to experience something emotionally. You can't know somebody else's grief. Well, in a sense, you can't know somebody else's grief unless you experience yourself. But you can sympathize with that grief. You can understand what it generally means, and you can think about it. But it's a denial of reason, and that's the whole purpose. The whole purpose of these cultural Marxists, or whatever they want to call themselves, social justice warriors, the new left, is to undercut and destroy reason. And therefore, what they want to do, and this comes out of Kantian philosophy, this comes out of the idea that our minds are barrier to knowing reality. Now, therefore, each one of us, so we don't know reality through our minds. Indeed, our minds are barrier to knowing reality. A reality is what our minds decide it is. And since at the end of the day, each one of us has our own mind, we each have our own reality. And if the mind of men and the minds of women are somewhat different, and I believe they're probably somewhat different because we have different needs biologically, then we perceive the world differently. And if the fact is that you lived a different life than me, therefore you have different experience than me, then you're going to have a different reality than me, since our minds create reality. So this is all a consequence of this separation of reason from reality. And by doing that, Kant's destruction of reason. And the whole motivation by Kant and Hegel and the whole that whole philosophical tradition leading up to postmodernism and to the whole nonsense that is going on, social justice warriors that are going on today, which are even less intellectual than postmodernism, which is saying a lot, is the destruction of reason, the destruction of objectivity, the destruction of reality, the destruction of our capacity to know, understand, and be guided by reality, and therefore be guided by our reason. That's their whole purpose. Again, it goes by to knocking down towers. But here, it's knocking down the most important tower we have, which is our mind. That's what they're in business for, the destruction of the human mind.
Okay, so, I think that subjectivism is, odd, considering how their affinity for social planners. And, I mean, that's another...
Yeah, but that's, again, that's another contradiction. Yeah, it's another inconsistency. But if you remember that their goal in the end is their own subjective power lust, if their goal in the end is to have a zombie apocalypse, is to see blood in the streets and things knocking down, if their goal in the end is to be emotionally satisfied, then they don't need to be consistent about anything, right? But and pointing out their inconsistencies is not going to change anything, right? So it's never stopped a subjectivist, right? A subjectivist will come in and say, there are no facts, there is no truth. And you look at them and say, how do you know that? Are you absolutely sure that's true? And, of course, that's a contradiction right there. But has that ever stopped a subjectivist? I mean, that's a claim of philosophers have been making forever against subjectivists. Well, if there is no truth, how do you know what you're saying is true, right? And they can't. So, but they don't care about contradictions. So if it's all subjectivism, how can you be essential planning? Well, all subjectivists at the end of the day are intrinsicists. All subjectivists at the end of the day well, all intrinsicists are subjectivists and all subjectivists are intrinsicists. All subjectivists and individuals believe that they have superior knowledge, that they commune with Plato's world of forms, that they know the truth, that they are good central planners because they know what's good for you, because you can't even know what's good for you. So, how do they get the world of forms? From their subjective emotions, right? So it's all emotionalism. All opponents of reason and rationality and reality are emotionalists. That's the only real conflict in the world, emotionalism versus reason. You can call it subjectivism, you can call it intrinsicism, but at the end of the day, if you're an intrinsicist, that is, the value is in the thing itself. How do you know that? Emotionally, because the value isn't in the thing itself. And if it's subjectivism, it's explicitly emotionalism. But yeah, they want to, their emotions, they believe their emotions are superior to yours, and they can help you, and they can make your life good, and I mean, they don't really believe that, but they that's what they advocate. But remember, they don't have to be consistent. We're the only ones who have to be consistent, because we believe in reality and reason. They don't have to be consistent.
And that's where our tyranny of experts comes from, and the whole intellectual left in this modern state. And
yeah, to some extent. I mean, they're variations on these leftists, right? Not all of them are nihilistic. Some of them truly believe, like Plato, if you will, that there are some people who are that most people are just live in a cave. They see their shadows. They don't know. They don't have the tools to know reality. And yet, some people do. They're elitists, metaphysical elitists, and therefore they believe that they are experts, that they can guide you, that they know what's good for you. So I wouldn't put everybody who is pro-state in the nihilist category, in the I want to smash stuff category. There are some people who, either mistaken or because they're still power lusters, believe that they are the philosopher kings in some way, or some variation of philosopher kings. They are experts. They know. And most people are too dumb. And I hear this all the time. All the time. People tell me, conservatives, right, left, doesn't matter. Right? The whole political spectrum. People are just too dumb to take care of themselves. They need guidance. They need the state. They need experts. You know, and to some extent, I sympathize. There are a lot of people too dumb to take care of themselves. But I'm not smart enough to take care of them. Right? They're just too dumb to take care of themselves, and they should suffer the consequences. And maybe if they suffer the consequences, they will learn. Right? But if you prevent them from learning, then they're certainly too dumb, and they'll stay too dumb to take care of themselves. But it's not my moral responsibility. But I can't. You cannot impose the good on people. You cannot make people think. And if the good, according to objectivism, the good is to think. If I can't force somebody to think, I can't force somebody to be good. So it's impossible, even if somebody's too dumb to take care of themselves, to get them to be good. Again, only reality can teach them that, but only if they suffer the consequences of their actions, and that's where you have to get out of the way.
Okay.
Okay, let's thank Robert Simpson for this interview. I think we got into a lot of cool issues and a lot of good stuff, so I really appreciate that. As you know, this show was taped. It was taped in early October, and when you're hearing this on October 15th, I am in Greece. I love Greece. It's a disaster. Modern Greece is obviously a disaster. But the whole idea, and this is, I'm experiencing this as you're listening to it, of walking in the footsteps of Aristotle and Plato. But it's not just philosophy. It's the great sculptors and the playwriters who I'm, you know, not educated enough or smart enough right now to list their names. But, you know, I love Greek plays and I love Greek sculpture. And it's just, I love the atmosphere that must have been Greece. And with all its faults and its all its problems, wow, what a time that must have been to be alive, to be surrounded by intellectual giants and artistic giants like they were, and a sense of freedom. Again, there were a lot of faults with Greek society, including slavery and the way they treated women and the fact that they ultimately killed Socrates. But this is a period in human history where we're discovering reason, we're discovering knowledge, we're discovering what human beings are capable of, we're discovering drama. Wow, Antigone and so all these other plays that are just fun, right? And again, philosophically flawed, but exciting. It's about what it means to be human, what it means to be a human being. So my positive value of the day is ancient Greece, the cradle of civilization, truly the cradle of civilization in every respect, the beginning of the study of philosophy as a science. It is only when we rediscover those Greek ideas, particularly Aristotle's tradition in philosophy and the Greek dramatists and sculptors in aesthetics, only when we rediscover these ideas, only when we take these ideas seriously, will Western civilization resurrect itself. There's no accident that the Renaissance was called a Renaissance. It was a Renaissance because it was a rediscovery of Greece. The Enlightenment is ultimately the Enlightenment because it is the bringing on of Greek ideas, the ideas of light, to lighten up our world from an era of darkness and bring reason and real art to man again. So go out, go look at a Greek sculpture book, or go read a little bit of Aristotle, go watch a Greek play. All right, this is the Iran Book Show, and we'll talk to you next week.